Let's have a word of prayer and we'll get started tonight. Heavenly Father, we're thankful once again for your word. And we're thankful for the wonder it is to know the Son of God. And we realize, Father, if Christ had not come, we would not know what you are like. But we're told that godliness was manifest in the flesh, that God was manifest in the flesh, and that was God the Son. And apart from that, Father, we would not be able to understand you, because Jesus even said in the upper room to his disciples, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father." Not that you're the same, we understand that, Father, but we would not know what you are like unless we could see it in the life of Christ and in the person of him. So we're thankful that he came to do this, and that's what makes this Christology so important. And Father, in this study now, as we see what the nature of deity is like in general, of all the persons, Father, may it be beneficial to us as well. May we come to appreciate more the God that we know and serve, and look forward to seeing face to face when we're made like Christ one day. We thank you for this time, and may the Spirit be the teacher. Amen.
Amen.
Now, we're coming to an end of a section. We're at the top of page 4, and we've looked at the essence, the nature of the essence of God, and there's only 4 parts to it. There's a little equation that you can remember. It's 4-7-4, and what that is there are 4 characteristics of the essence. And there's 7 attributes, and then there's 4 characteristics of the nature, I believe. Is that what I got? Or do I have 5? Let me be wrong. Let me go ahead and be wrong on that one. Nope. I have 6. Okay, 4-6-4. Anyway, so we're coming up to that. Now, when we look at the essence of God, there is a lot that we can learn from it. And this is just the essence of God. This is not his abilities. This is not his nature. But just in looking at it, one of the things I think it can do for us, and we should never think of doctrine as just some dry thing. I know I've said this enough times probably, but I like to think of it as doctrine for belief and edification. And these are things, if we understand what God is like, when you look at what God's essence is like, then you see that God is dependable. I mean, his essence is spirit. He doesn't have a body that gets tired. God doesn't have off days. You realize how good that is? I mean, God doesn't have a day when he says, "Well, I don't feel good today. I'm going to call in sick." Well, if God the Father did that, there'd be nobody there to replace him. And God the Father decided to call in sick. I don't know if you've ever thought of that, but in reality, this is what your Father is like. The essence of God is such that he doesn't get tired. He doesn't have to take time off. He doesn't have bad days. God is always the same, and this is something you can worship God for, because this is part of what we know about him, and this is part of what makes God up. Now, we're going to look at the nature, and we're doing this a little bit out of order, perhaps, because the nature of God is made up of the essence plus the abilities, and we're skipping to the nature, because the abilities take longer to go through, and we want to make sure that we get through this. If we do this second lap, we might not get through it as well. So, now, when you look at it, the nature is a result of adding the abilities to the essence. And you can see that in humanity and people, because when you look at people, we tend to recognize people and tend to think of them quite often in regards to what they look like physically, their physical appearance, their body. And that's normal. And we realize that sometimes determines how we act, the way we see ourselves physically. If you see yourselves as a clumsy person, the chances are, if you were clumsy in high school, you probably didn't go out for football or baseball or basketball or anything like that. You didn't try that out. And these abilities we have are exercised to the body, and the abilities we have when it comes to the body, it makes us, and it gives us a certain nature. For example, if you have an artist that does sculpting or painting, and you have an auto mechanic, they have different abilities, and they see things differently, more than likely. And so as a result, the nature of a person, they're going to be different. The nature of what the mechanic is going to be like is going to definitely be different than what an artist is like. There's no question about it. So it's the abilities that you have, plus the body that you have, and that determines what you're like. Now, the uniqueness of each of those results in a pattern of behavior. Now, we could say something about, we won't say anything about politicians. By the way, I told Dave I was going to do this tonight. Anyway, Do you know what the definition of a politician is? Politics? Does anybody know what the definition of politics is?
Uh-oh.
I'm sorry, I have to do this. It's my nature. Poly means many, and ticks are a blood-sucking parasite. Now you know what politics are, folks. I don't know what that has to do with Scripture, but... But the human ability, if someone is a politician or a humanitarian, they're going to have a different pattern of conduct. The politician will see things in a certain way. Usually dollar signs yours. You know, it's always nice to spend someone else's money. I'd love to do that, but I don't. But the humanitarian will see things differently. So the point we're getting at is the pattern of behavior is someone's nature. And it's made up of what they are, their body is. Now, God doesn't have a body, but it's similar to, we illustrated by that. God has an essence, and he has abilities. And so there's a resulting pattern of behavior that's true of God, of all the persons that God had. Remember, when we say God, we're not talking about a single person. We're talking about all three persons, because all three of them have that in common. One of the dangers of teaching theology proper is the tendency to say he and refer to a single person as though you're talking about God the Father. And I've tried to avoid that so that we see that we're talking about all three of the persons of the Godhead. Not just one, but all three of them. Now, what do we know about the nature of God? What's it like? Well, here's the first one. Immutability. It is the nature of God, all three persons, to be immutable. And we have defined that as the characteristic by which the divine nature is not changeable in their essence, nature, abilities, purposes, consciousness, and self-consciousness. And to put it simply, simple definition, the nature of God never changes. Now, that's a good thing. We won't even stop at that point. But we have there's some verses that we want you to look at tonight. We want to go to, start off by going to Malachi chapter 3, verse 6. Now, when you come here, this is a very, very, very important context to some people, perhaps more so than it should, because when you get here, you may have heard a sermon or two, or maybe more, a little bit further down than where we are, like in the ninth verse. We're not going to teach that tonight. But you'll notice in verse 6, it says, "For I am the Lord, I do not change. Therefore, you are not consumed, O sons of God." Now, this is a little bit stronger than you read in English. It says, "For I am the Lord." And in Hebrew, like as in Greek, you don't have to have a personal pronoun quite often, because the tense of a verb tells you. For example, in the Greek text, when they mentioned the word I me, which is I am, it says I am. You don't have to have a personal pronoun with it. If you do put a personal pronoun with a verb in Greek or in Hebrew, you say, I go, I me. Then you're saying, I myself am. It's emphatic. Now, Hebrew is the same way, because your verbs have an ending on them that tells you if it's the first person, singular, second person, or whatever. Now, the reason that becomes important is because in this particular verse, you have a personal pronoun in front of this. And I would translate this verse, and it comes across much stronger. It's I, Jehovah, I do not change. Now, this is apposition. It's I, Jehovah, I do not change. It's not just I do not change. That's one thing, but this is a lot stronger. It's emphatic. This would get your attention. I do not change. But now it goes on and says something else. You have the you as a personal pronoun, and it says in verse 6 when it goes on, it says, "Therefore you are not consumed. Therefore you are not consumed, O sons of Jacob. Or you are not destroyed." I translated that, "And you, sons of Jacob, you are not destroyed," is how you translate that. Now that's a little bit stronger. And when God says this, it's important. I mean, it's not just I do not change. It's I, Jehovah, I do not change. Now this is one of the persons of the Godhead speaking, but this is true of all of the persons. So you can see from this, it's very emphatic. Now, as you look at the context, it's talking about the future rule of Christ, the millennial kingdom. If you go back to the first verse, it talks about sending the messenger before his face. And then you notice it says that the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. This is all future. This has not happened yet. Now, we did have John the Baptizer. He did come. But now, he says, and suddenly the Lord will come to his temple. And so as you come down here, you notice that something else is going to happen too. Who can endure to the day of his coming? Who can stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire and like a launderer's soap. He will set this, a refiner and a purifier of silver. He will purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver that they may offer to the Lord an offering in righteousness. If you go on and look at this, this is prophetic. This has not happened. If you look at this, I would equate these verses in verses 2 and 3. I would look at what you see in Matthew chapter 25 about the judgment of sheep and goats, because when Christ comes back to his people, if you look at Matthew 25, at the end of the tribulation, Christ is going to come to earth to take up his rule and his reign. He will have already destroyed all the kingdoms of the world system as we know it. And he will sit down. If you look at Matthew 20, we don't have to go there now, but you can make a note to yourself to see that, because it does tell you there that he is going to judge his people and he's going to judge those that are living. So this is looking at that, I believe, looking forward to that time. Now, it's against that, and of course it goes on, and in verse 4 and 5 indicate that there will be a change, that now Israel, for example, will be... they will make offerings that will, see where it's at, will be pleasant, verse 4. And then he says, I am the Lord. Now, when God says that, in that context, what God is saying is, I'm not changing. I've said this. I am going to do this. But it's very emphatic. It's absolute. And the reason for the emphasis is because that God wanted the people who heard this message to know that this was serious to God. It's emphatic. I, Jehovah, I do not change. I've decided to do this. I haven't changed from doing this. And that's one place where, once again, you look at that, and that will help you and I, because the Scripture makes a lot of promises to us, does it not? How about the one that I like so well is 1 John 3:2. When we shall see him, we will be like him. Oh boy, I can't get that right. When we shall see him, we shall be like him. In 1 John 3:2. Now that's a promise we have. And how sure can we be of that? Well, if God doesn't change in the Old Testament, if God made a promise to these people and says it with a great emphasis, I do not change. It's not God's nature to change. He doesn't change things. If God is true back there, if God can be trusted to do that for the people of Israel, then I think we can draw some encouragement from that and see that he is going to do the same for us. Another good example of that is back in the giving of the law. If you want to know how serious God is about things, look at Deuteronomy 28. Take time to read through this chapter, because it is a very, very, very important chapter. It tells Israel, if you will keep the law when you go into the land, the first 14 verses say, these are the blessings I'm going to give you. And God didn't change his mind about this either. Now, he didn't say that after this, but this is another illustration. And then from verse 15 through verse 68, God says, if you don't keep the law, this is what's going to happen to you. And God didn't change his mind about that. And guess what? If you read verse 15 through verse 68, you have a pretty good history of Israel in the Old Testament. You see what happened to them. The end of the curses for them was they were going to be taken out of their land and sent all over the place. They would be kicked out of, and that's what happened. So, we can take, you look at that, and God is immutable. If God says he's going to do something, he is going to do it. And I like the way it's here. I mean, this is really a strong statement. I, Jehovah, I do not change. He doesn't change what he plans. Now, of course, you could go on down here and you'll notice that the people, he goes on, and the contrast is what follows. Yet from the days of old, verse 7, your fathers have gone away, you have gone away from the days of your fathers, you've gone away from my ordinances, not kept them. Return to me and I will return to you. So he says, I haven't changed. But then he turns to Israel and says, you have changed. You have changed. Yes?
John, your point is immutability, but is there any, do we have with any of the texts, do we have a clue where you have the emphasis of the personal pronoun in addition to the verb?
In the English?
I mean, in Hebrew.
In the Hebrew, well, it is. It's there. You have it in Hebrew. It's distinct.
But I mean, from the English text, do we have any clue where?
No, not really. No, you don't.
Really.
No.
Just slow down and take a little more time with some of these passages, and you'll find some of them.
Yeah, if you use an interlinear, a Hebrew interlinear, or if you have ESOR and you check it, and or if you have Bible Works, you go there and you'll find it is there, because the verse begins with I, the personal pronoun. Now, that's not an ordinary, in Hebrew, that's not a typical way to begin a sentence. It's an emphatic way to begin it. I, Jehovah. And then the verb is I do not change.
So Malachi 3:6, for I am the Lord.
It's
with what you've said, I'm thinking.
There's no verb in there, actually. There's no verb. It's I, the Lord. You notice it's italicized.
Yes, italicized. Yeah.
And I think if you leave it out, it comes through clear because you say, I am the Lord. No, that's not. I don't think that's what God is saying at all. It's apposition. I, the Lord. I do not change. That's a lot stronger than saying, I am the Lord, I do not change. Yeah. No, I don't think that's what he means.
And because you've said, these sorts of English, these sorts of verses in the English are going to begin to suggest to me this is more than just incident.
Yeah, if you see, anytime you see an italicized word, especially a verb, it may be long, it may be there in sense, and maybe that's correct to put it there. But the fact it's italicized, it you should stop and look at it and say, no, should it be there? Because in this case, it's italicized, and I don't think it belongs there. I think it changes the impact of the verse. Because if you look at what he says, in you are not consumed. Because I'm the Lord, you are not consumed. Now, the second one is definitely emphatic because you have you as a pronoun and then it's inherent in the verb. You are not changed. Or changed, but with a negative on it. So, there's no question in this case. The italicized word, in this case, I think, takes something away from it, the emphasis. It takes the emphasis away, and I think the emphasis comes across, and I think it should be understood, as I, Jehovah, I do not change. That's the way we should take it.
There's an intensity to it.
It's an intensity, and I think that intensity belongs there when you look at it. Because then he turns around and says, from the days of your father, you've gone away from my ordinances. You haven't kept them. Now, there's a contrast there. I haven't changed, but you people have. From the days of your fathers, you have changed. So, I don't think you'd appreciate it as much if you put that verb in there. And you can check. If you have the ESOR, anybody has the ESOR, I highly recommend you use it because you can look at these things and you can see where the verbs are, where they're not. You can look at it.
It's pretty clear here.
Yeah, and you can see sometimes because, like I said, in Hebrew, remember, as in Greek, your verbs carry the person. A first person singular verb is built into it. It means I am. But if you put the pronoun in there too, that makes it emphatic, and you can see that in something like the ESOR. You can find these things, and it helps you to understand it because, if you say I am the Lord, I do not change. Well, that's fine. That's true. But you miss something of the flavor. You miss something of the intensity of it because God has made some sweeping promises coming up to this that he said, and this is the last prophet. And remember, by the time Malachi writes, he's about the last one to write. There's going to be 400 years of silence. And yet, this last book of the Old Testament, you find God still saying, "This I'm going to do these things. I'm going to send this servant before me, he's going to prepare my way, and the Lord's suddenly going to come to this temple. He's going to come, and I haven't changed." It's much better to say it that way, the way we're saying it should be said, in the light of what's said, because it's the last thing it's said, and God says, "I still mean business," and he wants them to know that. So I think that makes it more important, and I think we would miss a lot if we didn't include that.
Well, that really changes the way you...
Well, it does, and I think,
and
if you look at it, many times in the English and in the Hebrew, and I'm finding that more and more, you'll find that the Hebrew comes across with a lot of dramatic things that you just don't see in English. And folks, you cannot appreciate the Bible as much unless you take the opportunity, if you have it, to check ESOR out. If you have it on your computer at home to look at these things, you can see a lot of these things. And there's some things there that you just... you're missing something good if you don't look for them, and that's especially true in the New Testament too.
So this is emphatic, and God says in so many words, I'm the Lord, I, Jehovah, I don't change. Now, you men did. They changed. But God doesn't. Psalm 102 is our next one. We're going to take a look at Psalm 102. I don't know that I necessarily set out to pick emphatic verses, but it seems like when you get to some of this particular subject, you find that God does the business. This is a passage which you find quoted in the book of Hebrews, and it has a slightly different little bit of emphasis here than it does in Hebrews. You notice what it says. Of old, well, it says, okay, let's be in verse 24. I said, oh my God, do not take me away in the midst of my years. Your years are throughout all generations. Of old you laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the works of your hands. They will perish, but you will endure. They will grow old like a garment, like a cloak you will change them, and they shall be changed. But you, the same. Now notice the all italicized. You are the same, and your years have no end. Now, once again, guess what? It's emphatic. There's an emphatic statement here in verse 27 where it says, for you are the same. And you have, once again, you have the pronoun you. You yourself, you are the same. You are standing, and you, your years shall not come to a completion or come to an end. It's emphatic, once again, in verse 27. You are the same. And your years have no end. Now, the contrast down through here, you know, when you look at this, what gets my attention in this is when we look at the heavens, you look at the sky, you look at the stars at night, and the tendency I always have had is, ever since I was a kid, say that they never change. They look like they'll last forever. And it really does, doesn't it? I mean, you know, as long as there'll be stars up in heaven, there's a song that's, I'll be in love with you as long as there's stars up in heaven. And you hear songs and poetry that refer to the heavens and how they never change. And yet we tend to think of them as being unchanging and they go on forever. But yet, by picking that, it says, you have laid the cornerstone of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. But they will perish, but you will endure. They will perish, but you know, how long have the heavens been here? Well, they've been here a while. Don't know exactly how long, but it says they're going to pass away. They're not going to be there, but God isn't going to change. You notice it says, they will perish, but you will endure. They will grow like a garment, like a cloak you will change them. They shall be changed, but you are the same. God doesn't change. He's immutable in his nature. Now, I'll tell you, when you stop and think about that, that's spoken to Israel. That's in Psalm. But that's wonderful for us too, because God doesn't change for us either. And that encourages me that, like we said already, God is not going to change. He hasn't changed. He doesn't change. And so, this one who's made all the promises back there, you know, it would be easy to say, and I can understand unbelievers sometimes, they say, well, you people believe in this book, it's 2,000 years old, it's, you know, these things were written by a bunch of mystics back whenever, yeah, that surely can't be for real. But when you realize that the last books of the Bible were written before 100 AD, and this is 2013, you're talking about a lot of years between, can we really be sure that these things that God has said are going to happen? Well, it says nothing changed. Nothing's changed about God. Nothing's changed about how he does business. God is unchangeable. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that he's rigid. You know, we have a note in here, and I should have mentioned that. When you say he's immutable, it doesn't mean he's rigid or inflexible or inactive. No, God is, in his plan, God is going to do things at a certain time. He's not rigid. He's not inflexible. But he doesn't change. If he promises to do something, he is going to do it. And I like the verses we see because they're emphatic, especially the first one. Now that's one that I can say that I will remember for a long time from studying it. Hebrews 1:12. This is a quotation in the New Testament, and it's got just a little tiny bit of a difference in flavor. In Hebrews 1:12. And it's a quotation from there, and I'm not sure if this is an exact quotation of a Hebrew or if it's a little bit more like the
the Septuagint. I'm not quite sure about that. I didn't check that, but it has a slightly different emphasis by the way it's worded here. I guess it'd help if I was not in Titus, huh?
That would help a little bit.
Yeah, it does. Titus 1 doesn't read quite the same as Hebrews 1. Okay, Hebrews 1, beginning at the 10th verse. And you, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you shall remain. They will grow old like a garment, and like a cloak you shall fold them up, and they shall be changed, and your years will not fail. Now he's talking about the superiority of Christ to everything else, because the book of Hebrews is a book of better. And he begins from the very get-go of this book about talking about how God has spoken to us, not by prophets, but he's spoken by a son, one that's his equal, and how he's superior. And it goes on in verse 4 to say he has this better name. And now it's this one. This is attributed to the second person of the Godhead. You laid the foundations of the earth. Now we know that from John chapter 1, because Jesus is the one that did the creation, the second person of the Godhead, the creator. So this is referring to him. What I like in this particular section is, and I'm reading from the New King James, so it's it says remainest. And that particular word is not just the normal word for remain. It's a fun word. It's a compounded word. And any time you compound a word in the Greek language, when you add something to it, you intensify its meaning, you change it slightly. And it has the idea of its use. And I looked this up. It has more the idea of you're going to continue. You're going to remain throughout it all. You're going to remain through the whole thing. And it gives a different feeling. It says, all the heavens, they're going to perish, but you're going to remain on through it all. And it gives you a different feeling than what you got in the Old Testament. He's going to remain through it. Not just be there, it just gives you a different sense. He's going to remain through it. He's going to exist right on through it.
What verse was that?
Now that is in verse 11, yeah.
11, okay.
Yeah. Now the problem I have, and I'm going to have to do something about it, is I'm reading from the New King James, and yet I take all my notes out of the King James from the study tools I have at home, so I have to once in a while adjust myself.
Are you wondering whether it's... Are you wondering about whether it's Septuagint?
Yeah.
I had a Septuagint.
Is it?
I don't have it.
Yeah. No, I meant to check that, and I didn't with the Septuagint, because sometimes you'll find quotes in the New Testament that are actually closer to the Septuagint, but I don't think this is one of them. But what I like, though, is here is remainest. It's remain through. It's the idea of continuing through something, that he's going to continue through it all. When all these things change, he's going to continue unbroken. That there's not going to be any change in him. He's just going to go right on through it, right up to the end. And this one that doesn't change is not going to change what he does or what he says. So, you will continue to do the same. Now, in verse, let's see, you are the same. Okay, Hebrews 6. Let's take a moment to go there in Hebrews chapter 6. Verses 17 and 18. Thus God, determining to show more abundantly to the heirs of the promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath, that by two immutable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we might have strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold on the hope set before us. Now you have it right there. You have to show the immutability of his promise, of his counsel. God's counsel is immutable. Well, if what God determines to do is immutable, then it's because the person that made this decision, made the counsel, is immutable. This section right here, now this comes right off of just yesterday when I spoke in Sunday school at Valley. And I spoke on Hebrews 5:11 and the warning, and I didn't cover everything up through the 10th verse or the 9th verse. But this is a warning to these people who were going to go back to Judaism. They were considering it because of what they were suffering. They had become carnal, you'll find in the context. And so he goes through that and tells and warns them what would happen to them or what they were doing, what they would have done. And then he makes a change and says that he was convinced that there would be better things from these people. And he goes on and
he begins to talk about promises, working back from Abraham, the promises to Abraham, to the promises that are for us. And it's interesting how he does it. Remember, these are Jewish believers. So he goes and he starts talking, beginning at the 13th verse. He said, "For when God made a promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, 'Surely blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply you.' And so, after he patiently endured, he obtained the promise." Now, I should have read verse 12. It says that he didn't want them to be sluggish and imitate those, but rather to imitate those who did, through faith and patience, inherit the promises. And so he goes on to say that as he goes from Abraham, through the promises made to Abraham, and God fulfilled those to these people who were going to go back, then he's going to turn after this, and verse 19, he's going to turn around and say, "Now we have something. God didn't lie what he said to Abraham. He gave Abraham what he promised him. Now he's not going to lie for us." So it's kind of an interesting flow here, because he's going to what these people knew from their Jewish background and saying, okay, now God can be counted on to do these things. He doesn't change. His counsel is immutable in his counsel. It's immutable. It will not change. It does not change. And because of that, he goes on to say, it's interesting how it, because in verse 18 it said, "Two mutable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we might have strong consolation who fled to lay hold of the hope before us." You notice the switch? Right in that verse, he's been talking about what was promised to Israel. And there's two immutable things. God made a promise, made a kind of covenant. The two immutable things, by the way, in verse 18. Do you know what they are?
The word and the oath.
Yeah, the word and the oath. Yeah, the word actually, when you look at these two things, he made a promise. God made a promise to Abraham in Genesis 15, and actually it was a covenant that he cut. He gave him a land unconditionally. If you go back to Genesis 15, God specifically said to Abraham, "This is the land I'm going to give you."
And his seed.
And his seed. And then in the 22nd chapter, he made an oath to him. Mm-hmm. And God's going to honor both of those. But now the thing is so intricate here is you'll notice that he's talking about that. And right in the middle of the 18th verse, he turns around and he says, he's done this, it's impossible to lie, so we would have strong consolation. We, as Christians, who have fled to lay hold of the hope that's before us. And he goes on and tells you what it is. This hope we have is an anchor of the soul, both steadfast and sure and so forth. In verse 20, where Jesus, the high priest, has come according to the order of Melchizedek. That's fascinating, because he's come back to Melchizedek, but you know where he started his warning to these people? It was over the subject of the order of Melchizedek. And so he's gone through that warning, and he's come all the way back, and he's turned it around. And so, whenever you read the book of Hebrews, there's always been discussion as to who was the author of it. When you look at sections like this, there's only one person in the New Testament I saw that ever wrote anything that was this intricate and this clever to turn it like that. That's the Apostle Paul. I mean, this is slick, because he starts off back in, if you look back in the 10th verse, he's been talking about, he says, called of God, a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. And then he says, of whom we have much to say and hard to explain, since you've become dull of hearing. And he stops at that point. He says, "Now you're dull of hearing. I can't say this because you weren't going to understand it." And he goes through a warning to them, and then he comes right back, and he winds up at the same place again, with these people trying to motivate them to go on, because God's not going to lie. Now the one thing about that is when you look at it, it makes you wonder what were these people thinking? You know, it says it's not possible for God to lie. What were the people thinking? If you look at it, it makes you wonder. They were beginning to think, well, maybe God didn't mean what he said. Maybe God didn't tell us the truth. Maybe they were beginning to doubt. And he turned around and said, no, it's impossible for God to lie. His counsel is immutable. Well, if what he plans to do and what he said he's going to do is immutable, then it should be pretty obvious that he himself is unchangeable. That's a good passage to look at. And Hebrews 13 is another one. If we look at the disability of God.
Well, of course they thought that they were the heirs.
Yeah.
They didn't see it. They didn't see someone else being the heir of the promise. They thought they were the heirs.
Well, one of the problems you have, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and in fact, I've been trying to get some work started on a forum paper that deals with some issues along related to this. And one of the problems you have is with the people of Israel is that God changed his program. Now, God can change his program like that, from Old Testament to New Testament, and God did. And at Pentecost, something new began. As far as God was concerned, he was now dealing with the church. And that was going to be the case right up to the rapture. That's the way God is intending to deal. And God did it like that. But now, do you think that that means people caught on? And the Jews said on the day of Pentecost, oh, we're no longer the kingdom. Now we're going to be part of something new that God's doing. That doesn't happen. The point we're getting at is that the people of Israel, for a long time afterwards, they wanted to hang on in some fashion to the law. They wanted to maintain their uniqueness as Jews. They wanted to be saved by grace, but then they wanted to, if you look at the book of James, you'll see that there's a mixture there of law and of grace. And of course, the book of James was written early. So when you come to here, and you're right, Richard, the problem that the Jews had in the church is that they did not understand entirely, and they weren't always willing to accept the fact that God had set aside Israel. And when you get to Romans 9, 10, and 11, you find that, yes, God did. And I'm sure when Paul wrote that, that was an eye-opener to some of the people. But in writing this, he's come full circle back in the sixth chapter and come back to point out that, no, you have a promise, something else, and you're going to get your promise. But he came back through Abraham, and you can see why he did that, because these people are still thinking in terms of kingdom and land. And if you want to see how bad it is, you can go back and look at Acts 15 and chapter 15, and then again in Acts chapter 21. Let's take a moment and go there. I hadn't planned on this, but my daughter reminds me I shouldn't volunteer for asides. And Dave gets asides, and Don volunteers for them. I don't know how that works, Dave. Is that a good thing or bad? Yes, no, if you're gonna put your feet in it, you might as well put them both in and jump in on top of it. Now, this is something that you really need to understand through the book of Acts and through the epistles. But the Jews did have problems. Just because God could stop one program dealing with Israel and start the church doesn't mean that people automatically said, oh, okay, that's the end of it. If you notice, Paul has come back to Jerusalem in the 17th verse, and Luke is with him, and then he says, and when we came to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. Now, that's Luke and Paul and his party. And on the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. And when he greeted them, he told in detail those things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, now notice he's talking about what God's done in the Gentiles. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord. Now if you stop there, it sounds good. They're happy. These Jewish people hear that the Gentiles are being saved. Now remember, that wasn't the case. The Gentiles were considered dogs. They had no place with Israel. And on Acts 10, you see the change beginning when Peter brings in Cornelius, and then Gentiles start getting saved. So to this point, it sounds good. And they said to him, you see, brethren, how many myriads of Jews there are who have believed, and they are all zealots of the law. Now, it says zealous in the New King James, and I believe it says zealous in the King James as well. It's a noun. They're zealots of the law. But they have been informed about you, that you teach the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying they ought not to circumcise their children, nor walk according to the customs. Did Paul teach the Jews among the Gentiles to depart from the customs of Moses, circumcision, and stop acting like Jews? Did he do that? Yes, he did. He did. But you notice, these people said, no, don't. Because it says they're zealous of the law. So when you look at this, and you see, compare this to the book of Hebrews, which is quite a bit later than this, obviously, you see that the people still had a problem. The Jews were still trying to keep the law. They wanted their uniqueness. They still had a kingdom mentality to a degree. And in the book of James, you see that they're still holding on to the law. And you see it here. So when you look at Hebrews and the other books of the New Testament, remember the Jews just didn't give up on the law that easily. It was difficult for them. And 1,500 years of history, and it just was not something that they could set aside. Well, unfortunately, that's human nature. God's changed things, but we just don't seem to catch on very well.
They still can.
Well, you know, that's one of those things. When you get right down to it, one of the things that personally I don't always like is when you have Messianic Jews that want to be keeping some of the feasts, and they want to be different. They want to be Messianic or Jewish Christians.
They want to be unique.
And my Bible says that there are the Jews, the Gentiles, and the Church of God. If you're the Church of God, you're not Jew or Gentile. If you're Jew, you're not the Church. So my Bible says that. But even today, and it's a strange thing that somehow even today, people just can't give the law up. People just cannot give it up. Well, that's the aside that we volunteered for. So we will not volunteer. No, we will not volunteer for any more asides tonight. Guarantee it. I will not volunteer. Now, if you take me on one, that's different. But I will not volunteer for another one. Yes.
Your Hebrews 1:12 and Psalm 102:26 is close. Septuagint.
Close to the Septuagint?
Close.
Yeah, I meant to check that and I didn't, so it's somewhat close to the Septuagint. the biggest difference I noticed is in the fact when we went there, it says, you will remain through these things. You will remain through them. It gives an emphasis to duration, continually going on through it, remaining through the whole thing without changing. Hebrews 13, verse 8. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. Now, that's a nice, simple statement. There's no, notice once again, this is another one of your verbless clauses. Now, you could put in there, in English, you could say Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. But it would change the feeling of it a little bit. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. It's more of a blunt statement. And in the context, you'll notice that he once again is talking about some various things. But he has, in this context, he's talking about, remember those who rule over you, who have spoken to the word of God, whose faith followed, continuing into their conduct. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So he doesn't change. And the things that the believer should do are in keeping with that. Okay. Well, let's see. We're going to go one more. Let's see. We have James 1:17. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. That's kind of an interesting way to put it. Father of lights, with whom there's no variation or shadow of turning. There's no shadows. God doesn't change. He's immutable in what he does. Now, what is important about this is this verse follows right on, right after the section on temptation, where it talks about how we are tempted, how believers are tempted. And you'll notice he says specifically in verse 13, let no one say when he's tempted, I'm tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. You notice he can't be tempted by evil. And then he goes on to say in verse 17, every good and perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights. Now it makes you wonder, when you look at that 13th verse, did these people have a problem understanding it? It says God cannot be tempted with evil. Why would he say that unless perhaps these people were not clear on that point? It makes you wonder.
Boy, that's interesting.
And there's one other thing we can say too. It says cannot be tempted by evil. That word, the word for temptation here, it means to test something thoroughly. The word that is translated, the Greek word that is translated there, and if you look at it in the room, you can see it's parazo, parasmos. It means to test something thoroughly. It doesn't necessarily mean for evil. It means to test something thoroughly, because you'll notice it says here, let no one say I'm tempted by God, because God cannot be tempted. But you notice it has to say by evil. If temptation meant evil, you wouldn't have to say tempted by evil. So this is a word that means to test something thoroughly. And this doesn't have to be a negative thing. It doesn't always have to be something that's negative. Yes?
In trying to give some clear understanding of this, comprehensive understanding of this, I pointed out that you, this pyrazo word occurs with reference to all three persons of the Trinity. You have it in Acts 5 and Acts 15. Acts 5 of the Spirit, Acts 5, 15 of God. It occurs to me, Acts 15, the context there, before the Jerusalem Council, James is there.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any reason to Peter's talking in James 15, he says, in the totality of what he's saying, he says, don't put God to the test.
Yeah.
With respect to whether we're going to force these Gentile converts to keep the law. Is there any reason to draw a connection there between that and what James is saying here and the occasion of James saying this?
Well, it says it is the word for pyrazo. Why tempt? It is the same word that you have here. It's pyrazo.
Yeah. I just wonder if there's any contextual reason to draw it.
Only to show you that it doesn't necessarily mean to tempt something to evil.
Okay.
You're putting God to the test. In a case like this, it almost has the idea of if you're testing God's patience. It's more almost of an idea like that. In fact, here you're putting God to the test. It's not that they were tempting God with evil or to do something evil, because God isn't temptable that way. But it just means you're putting Him to the test. And in this case, it's not necessarily evil. I don't think you can say this is evil.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's
cackling.
It's cackling. That which is lacking in character, rather than funny, Ross.
Yeah, and that, that's a good point. We overlooked that, but that's
something lacking in character.
God doesn't tend to anything to lacking in character. Now that's different, and there are two different words, and we should have mentioned that right off, but that's correct.
Yeah, good. That
helps. The reason we say don't test God is because we may not like what we get. Is that correct?
Well. I suppose you could say that, but no. The reason we say this is because this word is used a number of times, and it is even used once where Christ was testing Philip, and it's translated to test him. And he wasn't soliciting him to evil, because this word has the idea to test something thoroughly, to test to see where its weak points might be. Because when you look at Christ's temptation by Satan in Luke 4 and Matthew 4, Satan tempted him. It says he tempted him, but he was testing him to the breaking point. He was testing him to see where he was weak, if he was weak. And he hit him at the right time, because you figure 40 days, 40 nights without eating, you're going to be hungry. You talk about a good diet. I'm telling you, I wish I could go that long, you know. I can't go 4 hours without eating sometimes, but... we really miss something when we look at the idea of assuming it's automatically evil with the word tempt. It's not always that. It doesn't have to be that way. It means to try something thoroughly to see if it's got a breaking point. Now, when Satan was doing this, he was obviously doing this for the wrong reason. But you have it used, and it's in John chapter 6, where the same word is used, where Christ is testing Philip to see what Philip would do. Now, I've wondered about this, and I don't know the reason or what exactly Christ had in mind, but in John 6, in John 6, you have the word in the 6th verse. Now, this is just before the feeding of the 5,000, and Philip evidently was a man with some potential that he wasn't using. Or there must have been, and I'm not sure exactly why. If you have an idea, tell me afterwards, why would he do this? But you'll notice in verse 4, let's begin in verse 4 of John 6. Now the Passover feast of the Jews was near. Then Jesus lifted up his eyes, and seeing a great multitude coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?" But this he said to Pyrazu, to tempt him? Now, if you read the idea of solicit to evil, you miss the point. It means he was testing him thoroughly. He was testing this man to see evidently if he had faith. I'm guessing, I don't know exactly what it is, but it does say he was testing him. Now, there's a different word. This is not the same. It's fascinating because there's another word that is used in relation to believers in 1 Peter that's different than this. It's a word to test to approve, but this word just means to test something thoroughly. And the context has to tell you
whether it's good or bad. Because in this case, Christ is testing him, but is it for evil? Did Christ want this guy to sin? No, he just was asking him a question to see, did he have faith? Did he understand the potential? I'm not sure exactly what all Christ had in mind, but he did test him. And that shows you that when you compare that to what we saw back in James, that's why when it says in James that God cannot be tempted to that which is lacking in character. And we said, thank you for saying that, Dave. I should have remembered to say that. I didn't skip right over my notes. You always read, by the way, guys, if you ever teach and you make notes, make sure you look at your notes once in a while. It always helps. It gets you out of trouble, you know? And the other thing you should do is don't write your notes by hand like I did tonight, because if you do that, your handwriting may not be as helpful as it could be. I don't know if those kind of commercial messages are any good or not.
They're helpful.
You got some teachers in the room.
Why are you finding it hard to understand that Jesus was testing him?
Well, I can't understand. I don't know exactly he was testing him, but this is one of the just one out of the group. And why this particular person at this particular time?
But are we being tested nowadays by God all the time, or does God test us now?
Well, I don't know that I necessarily say that we're being tested by God. I'm not sure. Well, that's cool. I'm not sure I would go that far.
I don't have a problem. I'd be tested right now.
Well, we don't usually.
I wouldn't mess with it. You're looking pretty comfortable, man.
Well, that's one of those things. We got to remember that we don't determine our theology by experience.
No, I know that. I mean, to me, there's no issue about the fact that God doesn't
count on
that.
To evil.
Right. But past us, I think all the time. To strengthen our faith,
you know,
and help us move in our spiritual growth.
It's in trials our way.
Do we ever see pyrazo used to strengthen our faith? Trials, tribulations, various.
It does in James 1. If you start off at the second verse, it says, "Kind of joy, you fall into various trials," and that's the noun. Knowing this, that the testing of your faith produces patience.
Right.
So,
Romans 5:3.
Tribulation works.
Romans 5:3.
But it's tribulation there. It's.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's the same word. I'd have to look at that.
Okay, it is the noun form in James 1:2. So.
Yeah, it is. So you can see that. But the thing is that what this is not exactly what you might think. In this particular case, these are temptations that have come to these people, and they're not necessarily solicitations for good by the context. If you get on to verse 12, I don't think you'd say these were things that came along for good. These were temptations that came either from the old nature or from Satan. But if we hold up onto them, then we get something good out of something that was not intended for good. And that's one of the things about how God deals with.
Well, it's interesting that the noun form of that doesn't seem to show up in a context that's really wholesome. It's always a deleterious.
Yeah, but then again, remember that it has to be modified so you know where it is, or else by context will tell you. But in this particular context, where it says in various trials or various temptations, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. And I want to look and see if that fits it. Okay, that's interesting. There's a switch off. Knowing that the approving of your faith. So what it says in the verse 3, it says, knowing that's at the approving, the testing, the word for testing in the New King James in verse 3 of James 1 is knowing that the approving of your faith. And that means that you've been tested for approval. If you passed the test, this is a different word.
Is that your Petrine word that you made reference to earlier?
Dr. Monza? Yeah, it's a different word.
But if you've been approved of the test, then that means that you were tested.
Yeah, in this particular, but I think if you look at James 1:2 in the light of what he's going to go on to say, is that these were temptations. They weren't for good. They were either from Satan, your old nature, mm-hmm. but the the fact that you didn't succumb to them meant that you were approved, and your faith produces patience. You produce endurance, and that's part of Christian growth. So I mean, whereas temptation, when it comes from the old nature, it's not meant for good. When Satan tempts, it's not meant for good. The interesting part of it, you want to see a good example of that, and our time is just about up. But take a look at Job chapters 1 and 2. If you want to see how God deals with Satan, it's almost humorous in a way, because God baits Satan in Job 1 and 2. And Satan is determined that Job will curse God, he'll renounce God, he'll do all these things, and he doesn't do it. And it winds up that Job becomes, in the end, a better man because of what he went through. And that illustrates the fact that Satan, if you look at it, Satan did not intend for Job to succeed. He was sure he wouldn't. But you can see through what happened, God got glory at the end, and Job became, at the end, a better man for all of that. So it can happen. The temptation for evil can produce good results if we hold up under it. And I guess there are cases where God does allow us to be tested somewhat. I'm not sure. I don't know off the top of my head. I haven't got any verses that I can think of that would say that. Do you have any, Dave, in mind where it talks about temptation or testing pyrazo for good?
Outside of like 1 Corinthians 10:13.
Yeah.
10:13 is a noun form.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that some statement? Yeah.
But in almost all the other cases, I looked real quick for the nouns here, and in almost all the cases,
I wish I had brought a list. I made up a list at home of all the places where the noun and the verb were used, and I saved them in the computer, but I didn't bring them with me. I wish I had now. No temptation, this is 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation has overtaken you, except as such is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted above that you're able, but will with the temptation also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear.
Wow.
So that's testing. But please remember, if you look at the word the right way, it's not solicitation to evil. It's a thorough testing. It's a testing to see what you're made of. And when you look at it in that light, if you see that in the temptation of Christ, he was tested thoroughly. You look at Job is the same way. He was tempted. He was tested thoroughly. And yet, it can be something that is good.
Now, are you using testing and tempting interchangeably?
Yes, pretty much, yeah. Yeah, the word that I'm thinking of is the word pyrazo, which is...
Is that legitimate? If you go back to Greek and everything?
Mm-hmm. I would say it is, yeah.
The same way?
I would say it is, yeah. It is. Because it's the idea behind the word is if you go through it, and I went through all the uses of it and studied this a couple months back. I had a Sunday school class. I went over some of these things. As I looked at it, the word consistently means that you're testing something thoroughly, testing it to see if there's any points of vulnerability or weakness. And the context will tell you if it's testing for good or testing for bad. And the point we're making here is that it can be, even that which is bad can become good for us when we don't succumb to temptation, which is what makes our Christian life important. If we hold up under temptation, that what James says here, that the approving of your faith produces patience. It produces endurance. We become stronger for it.
The more victory you have, the easier it becomes.
Well, in a sense, that is true. I mean, it doesn't always hold up, but in a sense, it becomes easier. If you've learned how to overcome your flesh, if you learn how to deal with temptations you have from your old nature, maybe there's a certain one, and I think most people do tend to have certain temptations. They're vulnerable to the old nature. And if you had one that for years that you've always succumbed to, and all of a sudden you overcome it once, and then you overcome it another time, you deal with it according to Romans 6, you deal with your old nature the right way, it does make it easier, and it does build endurance, and it does make you a better believer. But now your old nature is not sending temptations up to help you. And Satan doesn't come along and send you temptation because he says, well, now, Bob over here needs to grow, so I'm going to come along and I'm going to tempt him to make him grow. If he does that, then you better reread Job 1 and 2, because that's not what Satan has in mind.
Yeah. He's going to have the answer.
Direction.
Yeah.
Is there also that scripture that says, flee the temptation?
Mm-hmm. Flee it from us, I know it says that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if it's used that way or not.
Or maybe that's translated in the NIV. flee the temptation.
I'll throw that away.
I'd be willing to put some
more. If it's from the NIV, we do not use NIV verses in this class.
You get Paul's use of the noun of Galatians for temptation, which was in my view.
You do that out there for bone form, you guys.
We have to use the authorized version.
That's right.
You were tempting.
That's a temptation right there.
Right there. See that?
He was tempting us. He was tempting us to go. No, I'm sorry. Time is up, and I already volunteered for one rabbit trail tonight. We limit ourselves to one rabbit trail. I already had it. We're not going on another one.
You said you would only have one.
Oh, that's true.
Okay. Yeah, right.
I had my rabbit trail, so you folks are entitled to have one too, I guess. Well, we'll come back to this and take a quick look at the last verse. But when you think of God being immutable, that's a wonderful thing, because I would hate to worship God, the Heavenly Father, and not know for sure that he was immutable. To think that maybe he would change, and maybe he'd decide, you know, I've had about enough of this guy. I've had about enough of this joke. You know, I mean,
change of mind about him.
I wasn't volunteering myself. You only guys don't have to laugh. I wasn't thinking of me. But seriously, it would be a terrible thing to think that, well, God could change his mind. Mm-hmm. That God might. I'm glad he doesn't. And that gives me hope, and it gives you hope, because if you look at some of these verses and you see God is very emphatic about it, he does not change. What he said he will do, he will do. And all the promises that we're promised to get as Christians, we're going to get them. Yes?
Could you maybe next week or sometime soon tie what we just said there with the fact that God repents at times? What does that mean?
What's
the difference between those two things?
Because
if he doesn't change,
he doesn't
say he can't.
I'm glad you asked that question, because that's one of those sticky ones that everybody actually.
Pretty sticky.
No, it's true. No, it's a question, and it's a good question. We'll come back and we will address it. You know, if God doesn't change, then how can God say that he repents? Good question. There is an answer for this, and I believe it's a good answer, but you have to come back next week and see. And if we don't go off on too many rabbit trails, we'll have a good answer. I will only bring one rabbit trail myself, so you'll have to provide all the rest of the rabbit trails for our class.
There's plenty of them out there.
There are plenty of rabbit trails to choose from. Okay, let's have a word of prayer, and we'll close tonight. Father, we're thankful for your word. We're thankful for the fact that we can enjoy it, and that we can even have a sense of humor at times that it's in keeping with your word. But we can recognize, Father, that you do not change your plans. The things that you promised Israel, though they seem so remote, and it's been so long since the nation Israel has been a nation that was yours, that was your people, yet in the future, even though it seems so distant, you are the one that says, I, Jehovah, I do not change. And we realize, Father, that those things will be given to your people. And we're thankful, too, Father, that because you're faithful to Israel, and you will do what you promised for them, in the same way you will do for us all the things that you promised to do in our salvation. And, Father, we can rejoice in that, and we can worship you for that, and praise you for your goodness to us. Thank you for this time, and dismiss us now with your blessing, we ask in Jesus' name. Well, my daughter did tell me not to provide my own rabbit trail. Don't volunteer. I said, okay, I had to modify it. So, okay, I'll limit myself to one.
You'll have to come next week and pin a bunny tail on you.
And there's always someone to lead you down.
Sometimes
they're good things. It's a good learning thing, though.
Well, like when you hit a temptation, you look at temptation, really, the word is, we miss something and we say it's solicitation of evil. It doesn't mean that. It means to test something thoroughly. And when you look at what happened with Christ, it makes a lot more sense.